So our next speaker is Indrek Ryland from University of Vienna, and the title of his talk is "What Is It to Say That P?"
Hi, everyone. Yeah, so I put another title on the slides, "Locution of Force," or "What Is It to Say That P?" So my talk primarily will be about speech acts and not about how the force content distinction plays out in the general explanation of representation and truth conditions, but it's closely related. So the notion of saying, I think, lives at the intersection of at least four projects, or is related to four projects, so the semantics of mood, then the distinction between semantics and pragmatics, where, you know, people are after a distinction between what is said, in some sense of like what follows from the meaningful use of the sentence alone, what follows from linguistic meaning alone, and what is communicated. Then speech act theory, in particular, what I'm interested in is the interpretation of Austin on the locution versus illocutionary distinction, and then also the literature on assertion, and the sort of heavyweight epistemic social notion of testimony or telling. So I will primarily focus on the first and the third today, but the larger sort of paper I'm writing tries to bring it all together. So when talking about saying or other acts, which I call locutionary acts after Austin, we want to relate meaning to use. And we want to do this, we want to understand the semantic significance of sentential mood, if it has any. We want to know what follows from a meaningful use of a sentence alone. This is what I'll call the locutionary act, or what is said. And then we want to know how what follows from meaningful use alone is related to communicative social acts, what I call illocutionary acts, also following Austin. So here's a plan. As background, I'm going to talk a little bit about Austin on locution versus illocution. Then we're going to talk about mood. Then we're going to talk about some problems with the way the view of mood that I like is standardly presented, or the form in which it's standardly held. Then I'm going to look at Francois' view of locutionary acts and then sort of present my own, and then relate it to some other things. Okay? So Austin. So Austin draws this distinction between locutionary, illocutionary, and perlocutionary acts. What matters for us here is the distinction between locutionary and illocutionary acts. Within the locutionary act, right, he distinguishes between the phonetic, the phatic, and the rhetic, or the full locutionary act. So phonetic acts are just making noises that are phonetically similar to expressions of a language. I mean, it actually takes some care to explain what a phonetic act is supposed to be. But in any case, you know, parrots are supposed to be able to perform them. When you cough and it sounds like go, you do perform the phonetic act, and so on. So phatic acts, these are acts of using expressions that do belong to a language. So therefore, the expressions you utter have to have a meaning, right? But and you also have to perform them as belonging to the language. So it requires some minimal level of competence on part of the speaker. So you have to know that they're performing to a language, belong to a language. So if I write a sentence of Estonian on the board and you all write it down, but you don't know its meaning, you've performed a phatic act. Yeah? So Francois gives this nice example, taking Searle's example of the American soldier uttering the line from Goethe's poetry, right? So the American soldier performs a phatic act, but since they have no idea what the sentence means, they're not saying anything, right? They're not performing a locutionary act. They're not activating the meaning. So there's this difference between uttering meaningful sentences, right? that can be just a phatic act still, and uttering those sentences with their meanings. That's what I call meaningful use. Yeah, so activating the meaning. Now, this notion of activating the meaning, of course, only makes sense on a sort of public language picture on which you assume that words have conventional meaning and so on and so on. Like, I don't think it makes any sense on certain Gricean views, and it doesn't make any sense in the Davidsonian view, in which it's just the speaker intentions, one off in every case, that are supposed to get us moving. So, in any case, so the rhetoric or locutionary act is using an expression with its meaning in a language. So if an expression has more than one meaning, you activate only one of them, not the other. Right? Plus, you also have to fix the reference where needed and supply other contextual parameters where that's sort of semantically sort of required. Right? And then all of these acts are distinguished from illocutionary acts, which I think Austin already understands as communicative social acts you perform in performing locutionary acts. Right? So there's this sharp line between the locutionary and the illocutionary where what's in the first follows from meaning alone, and what's in the sort of below the line is already something further, something communicative. So here's how to think about that. Austin also said, you know, phatic acts we report in direct quotation, locutionary acts we report already in indirect quotation. So for declarative sentences, their meaningful uses we report with say. For interrogatives, we report them with ask. And for imperatives, we report them by saying, you know, you tell someone to do something. And of course, all of these locutionary acts, when you perform them, normally you're performing some further illocutionary act, which is like the real communicative point why you use language at all. So in saying, you might be asserting or conjecturing or guessing or predicting. In asking, you might be inquiring in the sense of like you really want to know the answer, or you might just be examining someone, so you know the answer, you just want to know whether they know. And of course, with telling too, it's easiest to see, right? So we tell people to do things, but we might be ordering, we might be requesting, we might be giving them permission, we might be giving them advice, we might be just wishing someone well. So those are all illocutionary acts. Okay? So I think the fundamental distinction here, and it's a distinction we need for all these projects I mentioned in the beginning, is one between linguistic and social speech acts. Okay. There's a use of speech act where the linguistic does not even count as a speech act anymore, which is fine. I mean, that's just terminology. But like on the wider use, locutionary acts also count as speech acts. So the point of a locutionary act is it's supposed to follow from meaningful use alone. Okay, it's merely linguistic. Illocutionary acts, however, per Austin, are necessarily communicative or social. And he says, you know, in the sense that they're addressed to someone in particular, right? You have an addressee, you turn to them, you address their act. That's why it's all, you know, necessarily communicative. And they're in need of uptake to be performed. And then, of course, you know, you can sort of discuss for a long time whether the uptake is required for the act to be actually performed or to be successfully performed and so on and so on. None of this will matter here. The point is, uptake is needed only in the sense that, like, the speaker understands both the content of your act and the sort of, and that's the context in which Austin also mentions the notion of force, right? The content and the force are like what the nature of your act is. Are you asserting or are you just conjecturing or are you guessing, right? Unless they've understood this, you haven't either successfully performed the act or not performed the act at all, okay? And there's, you know, if we understand elocution as social in this sense that they both need to be addressed and they're in need of uptake, then there's always this question of, well, could there be something in between? I mean, could there be elocutionary acts which are not addressed? So Reinach, in his sort of theory of, well, sort of proto-theory of speech acts, or social acts mentions this notion of enactment, you know, enacting a law, making a law, right? And he says, well, enactment is a social act, but not in the sense that it needs to be addressed to anybody in particular. It's just in need of uptake from the population for whom you make the law to, but it's, you know, you're not addressing the law to anybody in particular. And, you know, it's also a possibility that there's some notion of assertion that's an in-between case. So Gary Watson might hold a view like this, Mitch might hold a view like this, Lionel Shapiro might hold a view like this. So this is a sort of view that, like, assertion is social insofar as, you know, you go on public record as being committed to this or that in a particular way, but you don't need to, like, assert to anybody in particular. Okay. So it might be that there are in-between cases, or maybe the elocution acts need to be understood in a wider way, that we delete the address part and think there are, you know, elocution acts that need to be addressed and that don't. But that's sort of how Austin spelled it out. Okay. You know, there are some cases where meaning already seems to specify an elocution act in the communicative social sense. So this was one way in which Searle objected to Austin's notion of elocution act. The idea, I mean, he focused on performative, like explicit performatives, but you get the same thing with hello and thank you. And a meaningful use of hello results in an attempted greeting. Since the meaning already requires an addressee, it might seem you already have like a communicative social act. So it might seem locution is already tied to elocution. But the distinction actually remains. This was already pointed out by Forgeson in his comments in Searle's paper. You can perform the locution act of trying to greet, or, you know, saying hi or saying hello, or like locutionary greeting, without succeeding in the elocutionary act of greeting, since there's no uptake, right? So the distinction actually remains. So you don't, even in this case, you don't get the elocutionary act embedded into the, or like encoded in the meaning, okay? Because the elocutionary acts require uptake. Okay, so let's talk about mood now. So I think the semantics of mood needs to explain three things, okay? First, a sentence of a particular mood can be used to perform locutionary acts of a particular type, but not of the other type. Then, more importantly, sentences can be used to perform locutionary acts, whereas the corresponding clauses cannot. Right? You can use P to perform a locutionary act, to make a move in the language game, self-standingly. Saying that P does nothing. It's not a move in the language game. And finally, reports. So we can only report speakers as having performed locutionary acts when they've used a full sentence. We can't report on their use of embedded clauses. If I add a P or Q, I can't be reported as having said that P. Okay. Now, there's two broad families of views which try to explain the semantic significance of mood. There's the content view, says mood doesn't encode any sort of force. You used to have it in reductive varieties where they tried to reduce all contents to one type of content. So Lewis and Davidson played around with these sorts of views. But nowadays, it's mostly held in a non-reductive form. So all different sentences have different sorts of contents, propositions versus questions versus properties, or, you know, some sorts of things with little pros in them. And what follows from meaningful use alone is the mere expression of the relevant content. Okay. That's their idea of a locutionary act. So that's the same as Searle's propositional act, or expressing Soames is entertaining. David Brown, Liz Camp, Capellan, Van Elswijk, they all use the word locutionary act in this sense, or sometimes the verb to locute. Right? The idea is the locutionary act, what follows from meaningful use of a sentence alone is just putting the content out there. No force whatsoever. Okay? And then there's, So the content view can explain difference, different contents, different locutionary acts. Easy, no problem, the non-reductive variant. But I think it has trouble with possibility. So on all of those views, it is held that a sentence and the clause share their content. And so then you want to know why it is that only a sentence can be used to make a move in the language game, and not the clause self-standingly. And then you get proposals like this. Well, there is a difference. A sentence expresses a content, a clause designates it or refers to it or something like this. Yeah. But of course, without any explanation of what this consists in, this just seems restating the problem in other terms, right? It's just a label for the problem. And it's a little bit hard to see how they can explain what that difference consists in, I think, without resorting to bringing in force one way or another. Okay? So, I mean, it's not like a full argument. This is, though, the reason why I much prefer the force view of mood. There's also trouble with reports. And it's good to spell this out for a little bit. So given the conception of locution acts as mere expression of the relevant content, it seems like we should be able to report on the use of embedded clauses. But we can't. Yeah? If I say P or Q, you can't report me as having said that P. And for example, I mean, Brown, with his notion of locution, just sort of stipulates that you can only use this verb to report the use of a full sentence, not an embedded clauses. But given his conception of what a locution act is, there is no basis for the stipulation. So it looks like the people who have held or who hold these sorts of views, they're sensitive to this problem they have with reports without actually like explaining why or what the basis is for ruling this out. So in contrast, you have the force view of mood. So mood encodes some sort of force in some sense, to be specified. And the force view of mood, of course, used to come pretty much exclusively, right? You saw this in Stenius, and to some degree, I guess, in Searle. Used to come in this reductive form. The idea was, you know, the content is always the same. It's the force that makes the difference. But of course, you don't have to hold that view in that form. You can perfectly allow that the contents are different in every case and still think that the difference between a sentence and a clause is explained by the fact that only sentences encode force. Okay? So I'm only going to consider the non-reductive version. And so in this view, what follows from meaningful use alone is a forceful act. So I think Austin sort of held this view, but like, you know, I have a lot of these question marks in there because interpretation of these people and those matters is difficult, but Searle and Austin definitely did. Right? They definitely hold this sort of view. Now, the force view can explain difference by different force and content, and it can explain possibility in reports by the fact that the clauses don't contain force. And so then the idea is you need some sort of a force to make a move in the language game. So here's a concrete proposal. Meaning is understood in terms of having rules of use and use conditions. You might think the use conditions for the word read is that you have to think of the property of reading, but the use conditions for the imperative sentence read is that you have to think of the property of reading, and then there's some X such that you have to address them, and then you have to have the desire that that person read. And so what you get on this view is a reductive analysis of the notion of telling to. So to use read with its meaning, right, to perform a locution act, is to express the desire that X read, or X read, sorry. So the notion of expression is just understood in terms of using a sentence with its meaning such that the mental state is part of the use conditions. And to do this via the use of a sentence just is what it is to perform the locution act of telling X to read. So the locution act of telling X to read is reduced to using the sentence with its meaning and, you know, the sentence having a particular meaning. Okay. So this is a concrete proposal. I mean, you could have the force view without having this concrete proposal. This just sort of illustrates how I think about this. Okay. Now, so insofar, like what I've talked about so far is these two views of mood, and I sort of like the force view, because I think it actually gives you an explanation of the things that need explaining. Okay? But the force view has almost always been held in a very particular form. Namely, and you know, I mentioned Searle and Alston, but this is everywhere, right? As soon as people start talking about force, they can't resist using the word illocutionary, as if all force is by definition illocutionary. Okay. And once you sort of hold this view, which Searle held, Austin's notion of locutionary act as forceful, yet distinguished from the illocutionary act, starts looking like a chimera. So this was sort of Searle's, well, in Searle's paper on Austin on locution and illocutionary acts. Because if you think that all force is by definition illocutionary, but locutionary acts already encode force, then you're just going to draw the conclusion that the so-called locutionary acts, the acts we talk about using the verbs say, ask, and tell, are already illocutionary acts. There is no locutionary-illocutionary distinction. And Searle says, that's Searle's conclusion. Look, what we really have are these neutral propositional acts, or more broadly, you might think just content-expressing acts. And then you have forceful illocutionary acts, the famous schema FP, right? And so this leads to the common view held by Searle, Austin, and others who hold the force view of mood, that the mood marker semantically encodes determinable or generic illocutionary force. It's already illocutionary, but it's like very determinable or generic. So it's like saying is, you know, you get a more determinate illocutionary act when you assert or predict or conjecture or guess, but saying is already illocutionary, just very generic. Okay. And sentence meaning is illocutionary act potential, as Austin later puts it. And I think this really makes a mess of Austin's original distinction. And these people, they lose Austin's, like the real notion of an illocutionary act as a communicative social act in need of uptake. And it has some like funny consequences too, because you know Austin sort of took the need of uptake to be like the sort of defining feature of an illocutionary act. Reina sort of said the same about his category of social acts. And then you see Alston talking about illocutionary acts and saying, what uptake? They don't need any uptake to be performed. I can say and ask and succeed without any uptake. Right? Which just sort of makes you feel like, well, yeah, now you're talking about locutionary acts, Alston's locutionary acts. You've sort of, you know, just change terminology, and now you're just talking about something else. Like, you've lost the original idea where it was built into the whole idea of an illocutionary act that they're in need of uptake. Okay, so this is the standard version. And now, autonomy strikes. So, lots of literal uses of language are non-serious in the sense that the speaker doesn't perform an illocutionary act like asserting or requesting or ordering. No sort of serious social commitment. For example, in the standard example, actors on the stage use language literally but are not asserting anything or not giving anyone orders. And Davidson drew the conclusion, meaning cannot encode illocutionary force because any sentence can be used literally but non-seriously without the supposed illocution resulting. And this sort of gets codified into the slogan of linguistic autonomy or autonomy of meaning. The meaning is strictly separate from any extra linguistic purposes, the achievement of which is always a matter of having serious intentions. Okay. And I think this view has at least some bite against, or these arguments have at least some bite against the force view as it is standardly held. So we seem to be having something like an inconsistent triad, the force view of mood semantically encodes force, the idea that all force is illocutionary, and then the thesis of autonomy. And Davidson and the supporters of the content view of Mood give up one. Searle also and most supporters of the force view reject three. But I think two is the real culprit here. So Francois thinks along the same lines, I think, and has tried to rehabilitate Austin's notion of a locutionary act. So he starts by distinguishing Hare's two concepts of force, tropic as a mood indicator versus neustic as actual commitment, for example, in the case of declaratives, to the satisfaction conditions, truth conditions obtaining. And Francois' view is a mix of Austin and Grice, I think. So he accepts the distinction, yet thinks that the illocutionary acts are more fundamental than the locutionary acts, and the locutionary act is explained in terms of the illocutionary act. So this is, like, I'm sort of writing two papers, and this one is very specific about Austin and his interpretation. And in that paper, I sort of argue, like, the real sort of big difference between an Austinian and a Gricean view is the one in the order of explanation. So Austin, even though he says that everything is an abstraction of the total speech act, he still explains what a phonetic act is without having to mention any of the others. He explains what a phatic act is without having to mention any of the others. He explains what a locutionary act is without having to mention illocutionary acts. It's a bottom-up order of explanation. Whereas the Gricean explanation is, of course, you start with intentions to achieve perlocutionary effects, at least on one interpretation, and then you explain everything top-down from there. And so what Francois does is he mixes. He sort of explains the locutionary in terms of the illocutionary. So the idea is saying the locutionary act conventionally indicates the performance of an assertion, which is an illocutionary act. Okay. In standard cases, the one saying is also the one who performs the assertion, but this doesn't always have to be the case, right? So here's the example. Your A says you're an idiot, B says I'm an idiot, thank you very much. So B says that B is an idiot, then thereby indicates the performance of an assertion that B is an idiot, but he doesn't perform it himself. He merely echoes the assertion of A, who counts as the enunciator. So B has said that he's an idiot, but hasn't asserted that he's an idiot. So that's how Francois rehabilitates the notion of a locutionary act, and the idea is to also use this to model cancellation, so we sort of heard about this today. I'm not going to talk about this right here. But I think this notion of a locution has trouble with reports. Given this conception of locutionary acts, we should be able to report on embedded clauses. And of course, that's sort of what Francois needs to use this to explain cancellation. But say reports don't work like this, right? If I, you know, if I utter P or Q, I can't be reported as having said that P. So I think there's still a problem with this way of trying to think of locutionary acts. So instead, I think we should just give up the bad and baseless assumption that all force is illocutionary. I think this mixes together the Phrygian notion of force qua commitment and the Austinian use of the word force in these rare few passages, actually, that you find, just to talk about the nature of a particular social speech act. So in Austin's sense, like, when he talks about illocutionary force, he just means, oh, like, what's the, you know, are you, like, asserting versus guessing? Or he doesn't mean it in the Phrygian sense of commitment. All of those are committal in the Phrygian sense. Right? He's after, like, finer distinctions. But Searle, I mean, this is just like a hypothesis. Searle sort of came at it from the direction of, like, you know, having talked about the Frege-Gitsch point and speech act analysis and whatever, so he thought of force in that way, and then he read it into Austin as well. And note that this distinction between two senses of force is actually different from heterotropic versus nousteic distinction. So I think heterotropic is just like not forceful in any sense. It's just, so the Phrygian sense is the nousteic sense. Austin sense is just like, I mean, I just prefer not to use the word force there at all. It's just what's the nature of the speech, like elocutionary act. So elocutionary acts of elocutionary force in the sense that there's speaker commitment of a certain sort. Saying is forceful and in that it expresses a judgment in Peter Hanks' sense, or what I call an S judgment or a semantic judgment to distinguish it from this epistemic notion of judgment that's in discussion in doxastic deliberation. This is much more basic. So this is the sort of thing that like is supposed to occur in every case a propositional act is performed. Telling to is forceful in that it expresses a desire that someone do something. However, locutionary acts and locutionary force is not communicative or social and doesn't therefore require serious intentions to be present. So that's all a matter already of elocution. So sentence mood encodes force, but it's locutionary force. It's force in the, you know, it's forceful in the Phrygian sense of commitment, but that doesn't make it elocutionary. Elocution is about something else. So one might wonder, doesn't Davidson's point apply even to locutionary force? Right? Can't autonomy strike back? And to a degree it can, I think to a much lesser degree though, but still. So one might argue it's not only that the actors on the stage aren't asserting anything or ordering anyone to do anything, it's also that they're not making a linguistic mistake if they're not in the use conditions, if they're not making this judgment or don't have the relevant desire. And, you know, that seems right. That seems like a good intuition to have. I mean, or at least we have this intuition, you know. We can't blame the actors for anything. They're not, you know, we shouldn't criticize them for what they do. They're not misusing language, something like this. Fair enough. But here's like the simplest form of reply you could give. Well, the actor expresses judgment, says something, thus does make a linguistic mistake. They're insincere in this very basic sense. Like when they say, ouch, on stage, and the use conditions for ouch are that you have to be in pain, and they're not in pain, they're making a linguistic mistake. I mean, that's just, unless you give a very different story of what the use conditions of ouch are, you're just committed to this. So they're insincere in this very basic sense, but you know, we don't fault them for it. Like, isn't acting a form of insincerity anyway? Well, so that's a very basic reply. Of course, Dammit basically makes this reply, but says a little bit more. Yeah. Dammit says, well, we don't fault them for it because they do it in a very particular context to further dramatic conventions. And, you know, that is why we don't fault them for it. Like, they are making linguistic mistakes, but you know, they're not really criticizable because it's clear to everybody that they're acting. They're not speaking in their own voice. So that's one type of reply you can give to this. And the other reply is given by Max Kobel. I only recently became aware of this type of reply Max gives in his 2010 paper. And he says, look, the actor doesn't express judgment or say anything, and therefore is not making a linguistic mistake. The actor is acting even of saying. All the actor is doing is performing phatic acts, basically. They're not really even speaking English. Okay, it's an interesting response. You could cook up cases where, you know, you sing a whole opera without knowing the meaning, so you're not, you know, you're not speaking Italian while you're singing the opera, and everything goes through perfectly well. We can imagine that there could be cases where, like, you do a better job acting a part if you need to be super deadpan or whatever, and like, you just have to act a few lines, so you just memorize them in a different language, and you'll do a better job if you don't understand the meaning. So phatic acts will get you there. But yeah, so these two sorts of replies are the sorts of replies that you can give to autonomy striking back. know, most people will remain unconvinced, but my credence in there being an alternative explanation of how mood works is much lower than, you know, one of these replies being the right story of what to tell. So that's how I feel. Okay, so now two more slides, few consequences. So to paraphrase Sellers, I think the term he said this about was recognitional capacity, but since the term assertion is one of those accordion words which can be used now in one sense and now in another, it's a menace to sound philosophy. That's sort of how I feel as well. The word should just be banned, and we should just draw finer distinctions. Because there seem to be at least three different concepts of assertion. And it's not like when we're talking about these things, we shouldn't pretend to be talking about the same thing. So there are some people who think assertion is just a speech act you perform by uttering a declarative sentence with its meaning, and those people also at the same time then think mood encodes force, and then they just call that act assertion, but that's just my locution act of saying. So Dammit, Max Koelbel, when Peter Hanks uses the word assertion, I think he probably just means this. Mark Jerry, sort of, but like, you know, then things get tricky because he says all sorts of other things as well. And then, so this would belong on the locutionary side. But then there are at least two other concepts of assertion as an illocutionary act. So one concept in which it's an illocutionary but not an addressed act, it's sort of like going on public record. Again, Watson Green Shapiro, for example. And then there's this notion of assertion, or what's sometimes called telling, is a social act similar to promising and requiring addressing somebody. So you find this in assurance views of testimony. So these are just three very different sorts of things. We shouldn't use a single word to theorize about them and then argue over, you know, which is the correct view, right? And another connection. So I think the view of locution acts as forceful in the neustic sense of commitment meshes very well with taking the forceful to be primary in accounting for satisfaction conditional content, or, you know, rejecting the forced content distinction in the explanation of truth conditions or representation with, you know, the judgment first view, right? So you might think, you know, this is how it works in the case of declaratives. You may use the sentence, if you think of Bertrand, think of the property of being British, predicate the latter of the former, and then to do that just counts as judging that Bertrand is British. So, and I think it also meshes well with taking the forceful to be primary in information encounter. So that's Eric's view. I think this is probably best put as the view that every bit of information is as judged to be the case immediately when it comes in. So even though I haven't really talked about the propositional content forming part here at all, I think it's very natural that if you reject the force content distinction there, you would also think that that sort of force, which is primary there, gets encoded directly into the mood and then leads you to the locutionary act of saying, which is already forceful. And that, I think, is sort of supported by the fact, which a lot of people talking about locution seem to miss, that you can't, you know, use say reports to talk about embedded sentences or embedded clauses. Thanks.
Questions? Mitchell Green.
Thanks, Indrek. Enjoyed that. I'm just trying to push at the idea that you can't use saying reports to get at embedded clauses. I wonder if that isn't just one of those cases of it's unusual, but not impossible. So, you know, we don't use the phrase in English, spring chicken, to refer to people who aren't old. You never hear somebody say of a two-year-old child, now that's a spring chicken, but who cares? That's just a, you know, fact of usage. You could and coherently use that phrase to talk about a two-year-old. And likewise, think about cases like, you know, a couple kids playing and one runs into the other, you know, to their mother or father and says, Johnny said fuck. It might have been an embedded clause, right? We can still report it quite appropriately. So for pejoratives and so forth and slurs, we can use SANG reports even for embedded utterances, it seems to me. And so the way I would put it would be, SANG reports can be applied to embedded clauses, it's just that they're very misleading in many cases. So if you say if P then Q, and I say Indrek said P, or even said that P, I think it'd be very misleading to just leave it at that and kind of uncool. But I don't think it's a conceptual confusion. I just think it's like using a phrase spring chicken to talk about a two-year-old or So do you have a, I guess a question would be something like, is there a principled reason that supports your claim that we, that isn't just, you know, the theory that you use that as a support for, that we could appeal to explain why? There's a bar to our using SANG reports for embedded clauses, or would it be, you know, am I within my rights to say it's just not the done thing, but there's no conceptual barrier?
Yes, very interesting, thanks. So I mean, as far as like Johnny said fuck, right, then there we don't use the that clause, and like I perfectly grant that there's some SANG reports which don't take that clauses, which are not yet reports of locutionary acts. So those should not matter at all. But as far as the view that, like, it's not really a semantic problem, it's just sort of not the done thing. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I mean, we would really have to find some cases where, like, we feel like this could be the done thing, like we could do it and have an explanation of the sort of, like, why this is not in general the done thing. Like, whether I have an unprincipled bar or reason that's theory neutral, then probably not. I mean, I think some evidence for this, and it's sort of interesting that I've searched for somebody give this type of argument explicitly and I've never found it, is that like every verb that takes that clauses seems forceful. So every like speech act or attitude verb that takes a that clause. Whereas when we want to start talking about neutral things, we always switch to noun phrases, right? So we don't say you entertain that P. We say you entertain the proposition that P, right? We consider the proposition that P. You express the proposition that P. So to talk about anything neutral, you have to switch to noun phrases. So in every case where it takes a that clause, it seems committal or forceful. And that, I think, is some evidence for, you know, if say works like this, we don't, like, say the, you know, Francois said the proposition that P, right? So we say Francois said that P. I mean, that's some evidence for thinking that it's forceful. But, like, from a more theoretical point of view, I think the whole package or like, let me put it this way. So the part about reports is actually like very closely related to the part about difference, right? Like what we need to explain in the semantics of mood, I think, is why we can use a full sentence to perform a locutionary act to make a move in the language game and not a bare clause. So it's sort of, I think, this is related to this, the data about reports. And the force view gives like a nice unified explanation of both things in one fell swoop. But whether there's like a more theory neutral way, I don't know. I think it would be, yeah, to like sort of understand this better, we would have to have like a concrete proposal of, you know, here's some cases where like you do this and it goes through and it's fine, and some idea of like why it's not generally a done thing. And so unless we have some story like that, it's hard to evaluate that proposal.
I'll try to come up with such a story by dinner time.
Good.
Thank you.
So first, let me say something about what you've just said about the verbs, the sort of the neutral verbs that take objectual complements rather than that propositional complements. You have suppose that P, and suppose is supposed to be neutral. It takes.
But how is suppose?
You don't suppose the proposition that P, you suppose that P.
But if you suppose that P, you're supposing that P is true. That's not neutral.
That's all not right, you can deny that it's neutral, but people who talk about neutrality, typically they would say that supposing is a Well, maybe not. Maybe.
I mean, it's not neutral in this one sense that I'm interested in.
Imagine that P. So you might say for all of them that they are not neutral, and I agree, they are not. But the people who talk about neutrality assume that such cases are neutral.
Yes.
But anyway.
So now we're dealing with different senses of neutral and forceful, which is interesting, which is worth thinking about. Yeah.
So it's a really a clarification question. I've not quite understood the objection you raised to my view. You said that my view about locutionary acts, the idea that locutionary acts should be characterized in terms of illocutionary acts, the idea being that we have conventional devices for indicating which sort of illocutionary act we are performing when you use language, and actually that's how we should analyze the sentence and meaning of sentences. The meaning of sentences is sort of a image of the sort of the speech act that you perform. It's indications concerning the speech that you perform. The meaning of the sentence is there to enable the hearer to understand which speech that you're performing. So that's this sort of view, the view that was actually present in Searle and in others. So on this view, I said that the locutionary act is simply the act of using those conventional means and thereby indicating that a certain speech act is being performed. Now, it's another question whether the speech act is performed or not. So that's the question about whether which illocutionary act, if any, you're performing. That's a question about the social act and so on. But the locutionary act is simply the act of indicating, using certain conventional means, indicating the performance of a certain illocutionary act. And that's independent of whether the act is performed or not. So my idea was that that's what the locutionary act is. And indeed, there are two cases, the case in which the illocutionary act indicated is actually performed, and the case in which the illocutionary act indicated is not performed. So you said that you raised the objection that, on my view, it should be possible to use the speech report that typically corresponds to the locutionary report. He said that P, or he asked me to do this, or so on and so forth. It should be possible to use that form to report the use of an embedded clause. I don't see why that follows. The idea is that we have certain linguistic forms that indicate the performance of certain illocutionary acts, for example, via mood markers that sort of indicates which type of illocutionary act has been performed, and there are other elements that pertain to the content of the illocutionary act, let's say. And typically people think that sentences actually carry this sort of mood marker or illocutionary force indicator. But if you embed a sentence, if the sentence now is a part of a more complex sentence, then this is somehow, there no longer is an illocutionary force indicator there. Whatever the mechanism for canceling is, it's not present there. So this notion of illocutionary act simply says that whenever there is an illocutionary force indicator, and whenever the meaning of the sentence can be construed as a sort of indication concerning the illocutionary act that's been performed, the locutionary act is the act of indicating that a certain illocutionary act is performed, and typically you would not have that when you're only considering a part of a sentence, like a sort of clause. A clause itself doesn't carry, because there is this canceling element that it's embedded and so on, so it doesn't carry this illocutionary force indicator. So that's the sort of standard view, and that's the view that I had in mind when I presented that notion. Of course, if you take on board my later extension of the view to account for force cancellation, maybe you will derive some kind of distance. Then maybe that's what you had in mind. But I think you shouldn't, if you want to attack this notion of locutionary act, we should forget about this stuff about force cancellation that's super added. Okay. So there is this theory of locutionary acts. That's one thing. Are there objections to it? And I'm simply saying that what you said shouldn't be an objection, because when the sentence is embedded, mood marker and so on is no longer relevant, therefore you can sort of deny that there is this indication, and therefore you shouldn't report that using the locutionary forms of reports. So that's one thing, this theory. And then there is another issue, which is, can we apply this theory of locutionary acts to solve the problem of forced cancellation? That's another issue, but let's...
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, I just took your view, I just took like the whole package as if the idea of to use it for force cancellation was already part of the original proposal.
No, I
think as soon as you take that on board,
Then
it doesn't work anymore with the SAY reports. If you, of course, say that like that was not part of the original package, then of course that my argument just doesn't apply there. But I mean, this is a more general thing that I'll say. And I didn't really mention this. I mean, this is not like a concrete argument. I just sort of have an aversion to Gricean stories. So, and so if you understand the illocutionary acts like as these social and communicative acts, then even on the sort of explanation you give of locutionary acts, we're sort of explaining language use partly, like, you know, dependent on the wider notion of communication in the social sense, which is, you know, the Gricean order. And I mean, you know, probably there is something to this order at some level of theorizing. Whereas I've always liked more the sort of what I take to be the proper Austinian idea that, like, you can understand language and language use without having to mention the wider communicative situation. And then, I mean, that's like a dividing line between the way I think about it and the way your notion is spelled out. And that's, of course, not an objection. That's just
I understand that there's...
That's just a difference in, like, the larger project.
If I may add something about the sort of size, sort of another issue, this stuff about the inconsistent triad and this encoding thing, this notion that the mood encodes force and the objections that actually it's possible to use the form without actually performing the act and so on. I never understood this really. If we, of course, encode is very ambiguous. I take it that in a sense it's, we can hold the force view, what you call the force view, and say that mood encodes force, but not encodes in the sense that whenever you use that form, does it have to be the act? Of course not. It should be defeasible. It's just that it's signals, indicates, but there are cases in which you indicate, but still the thing isn't there. It's like anything. So it's so obvious. No one would hold this encoding view if it wasn't understood in the stronger sense, because the autonomy fact is pretty obvious.
Right. I mean, that's one way to go. But like, I would think that's like, you know, adding wrinkles to the simple theory in which the idea that mood encodes force just means it follows from meaningful use alone every time, like can't be defeated. There's nothing like that can happen. Like just the same way in which whenever you use a name which has a particular meaning, let's assume to talk about a particular person, every time you use it, then the meaning is activated. You count as having referred to Mitch. The same way I think the simple explanation is mood encodes force in the exact same sense. There's no defeasibility.
I don't think that works even for the case of names. You have to say something the correct use. Whenever you use the name correctly, it's always possible to use a name and by mistake, slip of the tongue, whatever, you are not referring to the...
But why? I mean, if you take...
It depends. If you have a notion of reference that depends, that's...
If you take the relation to be normative, even in the case where you're violating the rule, when you're making a mistake, that still follows. That's why you count as making a mistake, because you still like count as having done that, right? If I say ouch, even if I'm not in pain, even if you know, like, even if I, we might think if I'm sort of my competence with English is partial and I've mistaken the word ouch for oops, but I still count like a competent speaker enough to be a participant in the practice, and the rules apply to me, I count as having expressed
sort of
pain and I've made a mistake. That's why I've made a mistake.
You're sort of committed to being in pain, you can say that.
Yes, but that's
that
all I
mean.
That doesn't
mean that whenever you say out, you are in pain, and the same way, whenever you use the imperative mood, that doesn't mean that you necessarily are performing the neurocutional act of the directive type.
But
you're
why?
Committed to it or to something like that, perhaps.
But my sense of commitment or my explanation of what it is to say and tell just is exactly the same in the case of ouch. Like in the case of ouch.
No, ouch is fine. You can use that as a
no, the point is, like there, the point is you count as having expressed your pain, no matter whether you are in pain or not. Well, in the case of a declarative, you count as having expressed your judgment. Whether you don't perform it or perform it or don't perform it.
The trick is done by the word express.
Yeah.
No. I thought that you had in mind a sort of factive notion of encoded meaning that if the thing encodes this, the thing that's encoded must be there.
Oh, well, of course, I don't hold that.
In the sense in which you're using it, you can express something that you don't feel. You can
Yeah, of course.
Feelings that you don't feel.
It's so an entirely sense, normative notion of express.
But in that sense, there is no problem at all with this encoding. If that's what you mean by saying that mood encodes force, then those autonomy things, they don't object to that because you express something of the sort.
But I think, I tried to...
is not fattive.
So when I discussed the autonomy strikes back part, I've rephrased that objection exactly in these terms that it would even apply to my view. And the objection then takes this form that if an actor is on stage and uses an imperative, directed at somebody, and when they don't actually have that desire, right? Even my view predicts they made a linguistic mistake. And I took the autonomy striking back to object to that. So that's the way in which autonomy still sort of... counts as an objection, right? I mean, that's why I sort of thought that, like, if we move away from the idea that it embeds illocution force, a lot of the autonomy, like, a lot of the force of autonomy goes away, but not everything. It still strikes back.
Okay. I may just be being slow when I ask this question. I may just be asking you to repeat an argument you made in your talk, but tell me what is wrong with the following view. There is only one kind of force. There, illocutionary force. But that concept of force submits to taxonomies. So there are supertypes of force and subtypes. And the notion of saying is one of these genus level or supertypes of force. And then the other kinds of, that there are subtypes of that, asserting and so on. But it's just one univocal notion of force that are where those notions of force are more or less general. And it might be that the higher, like the more general genus level notions of force, because they're at that high level of generality, we don't include the more social aspects of those acts because those are all gonna be, those are gonna be different for the different subtypes. And so when we're speaking about force at that general genus level, we just leave out, we don't specify any of those social aspects to that notion of force. That strikes me as, what's wrong with that? You don't, that's something you reject, and I just want to ask you to say again what's wrong with that.
I don't reject the view in its substance. I can agree to all the details in its substance. My point is, can be in some sense construed as a more terminological point, but I think it's not the sort of terminological point that doesn't matter. It matters because the notion of an illocutionary act is used across literatures, and this very Searle Alston view that you just described basically is definitely not the view of illocutionary acts that's used in the, you know, feminist philosophy of language when they talk about silencing or like some testimony literature or whatever. Because so this is like the Searlean use of illocutionary, where then force just means commitment in the neustic sense, and fine, like my locutionary acts are also committal in this sense, and you could like say, oh, these are just these very generic, and there's, you know, then there are all these specifications. But there's a fundamental dividing line in kind, like ultimately what I care about, the linguistic speech acts and the social speech acts. What's there encoded in the meaning? What's further in communication? That's the dividing line I care about. And it's useful to have a pair of terms, a different pair of terms, to talk about them. And I think Austin already had such a pair, locutionary versus illocutionary acts. And what Searle and Austin sort of made a mess of is using illocutionary acts to talk about partly, you know, what's encoded in the sentence meaning. And then there's a host of other literatures which use the illocutionary act in Austin's original sense. And then you get like messy arguments where Austin now argues, you know, illocutionary acts don't require uptake, which just shows that he's talking about a very different notion or a different type of thing, right? It makes no sense to deny that Austin's notion of illocutionary act doesn't require uptake unless you switch to talking about different sets of examples. So it's not really like a... like, there's nothing wrong with the view you described. I mean, unless you build into the view that they're the same kind of thing, that the genus and the determinables and determinate are the same kind of thing, because they're fundamentally different for me. So one, on the one side are the linguistic acts, on the other side are the communicative social acts. So you could have a term which talks about both together, fine, speech act, but you also need terms to distinguish them. And so the putting the view the way you described it makes it sound like they're the same kind of thing, whereas I think they're fundamentally different, right? The locutionary acts, they belong on the side of semantics, basically. Everything else is like pragmatics. So So the Searle Austin way of doing this hides from view like a lot of these distinctions. So another thing we've talked about is that the notion of indirect speech act, once you draw these distinctions, starts looking like a very dubious thing. You don't really need it, right? Because you could be performing whatever elocutionary acts when you perform a locutionary act of the, and you can only talk about indirect speech acts in the sense of, like, you know, whether they have the same sort of content or not, but that's not a very interesting notion anymore.
Why not say that linguistic forms, moods, are connected to the genus level, the supertypes?
You can say that as long as you say that that there's a dividing line between the genus and the species, which is they are fundamentally different in nature. So like the locutionary acts, they're not communicative by nature. You can perform them by yourself. They don't require an audience. You can like go around and say things. Yeah, they're just what follows from language use. Whereas all the other stuff, the communicative social acts, they require me to address you. A particular normative relationship between us is addressed. They're just fundamentally different kinds of things. So like, I think it's just misleading to present this as a sort of, you know, the same kind of thing, but one is like more determinable and the other one is more determinate. So that's ultimately what I care about, yeah.
Yeah, thanks, Indrek. You seem very impressed with Davidson's arguments. Honestly, I always felt somewhat, thought they were somewhat underwhelming. So maybe we should talk about that, and let me try to draw you out a bit on what you think strength is of that argument. Now, it seems to me, the reason I'm not so impressed by it, it seems to me they're just different dimensions of speech. Yeah. So the force, whether something is an assertion or direction, so that's what I will mean by force or question and so on. And then the question whether you're serious or whether you're joking or whether you are on stage, whether you're writing a novel and so on, what Austin calls the dimension of seriousness, it seems to me are just independent dimensions. And I think to attack the Frege point and the whole complex of issues that are connected to the force content distinction, it's important that we distinguish the different varieties.
Yeah, I deny all that.
the different varieties of force, and we have to see that all these are marked independently. And of course, the actor on stage plays asserting and directing and asking questions just as everything else. So don't we need an account which makes us intelligible to us how the actor is using that language, even on stage, or the jokester, and so on. And so let's take, for example, Searle's argument that he makes about fiction. So he says it's wrong to think that, say, terms like red and green and table and so have a different meaning in fiction, like in a novel or on stage and so on. Now, it seems to me, though Searle doesn't do that, but it seems to me that the same argument can be extended to force indicators. Yeah, it's not the case that, so of course on stage, people use the very same force indicators that they use in novels and so on. So isn't it the case that we need to account for this in the same way, and how would you account for it? And you, of course, when we ask the question of responsibility, I would again say it's a matter of the highest level act. Yeah, so, and the highest level act on stage is pretending. So let's assume, yeah, as a like toy theory of fiction, basic idea of a theory of fiction. So then the actor on stage is pretending to assert and so on. And of course, because the actor is pretending, is not responsible and doesn't make mistakes in that sense, but might be uttering or presenting assertions that are mistaken, if we assume that really assertions or truth valuable content is produced in any sense, which could be doubted, like Francois was talking about earlier. So, but yeah, so what is your response to saying, taking this line to say these are all different dimensions and they must be independently marked, and we have to understand how force indicators are used even in non-serious contexts, and how do we account for their meanings?
But my view does all that, right?
Pardon me?
My view does all that. My view has the strong commitment that if the actor on the stage is speaking English, which the Kobold-style reply denies,
yeah,
then they are expressing the judgment. And then they're making a linguistic mistake. If they don't have the judgment, we just don't care about this. So all the meaning of food, the meaning doesn't change on stage in any way. Force indicators, the mood markers, in my view, are used. I just think that Hare's tropic-neustic distinction doesn't make a lot of sense. The tropic is not a notion of force. All force, like the real notion of force is commitment, is just the neustic. That's the Phrygian notion of force is commitment. And so, like, I think sentence mood encodes commitment, like in the neustic sense. Every time you use a sentence, you express a judgment, a full sentence, right? Of course, my view of embeddings is very different, because I think it's a complete mistake to treat the actor and embedding as somehow similar, right? In embeddings, I think it works differently. Like, the mood gets stripped away, a clause gets formed, and that gets fed into the composition. So that's a very different sort of thing. That's the sort of view, which I haven't mentioned here at all, but which came up a little bit before. But yeah, so, I mean, when you said, you know, the meanings of mood markers or force indicators need to be taken into account, I do directly that in the most direct form possible. And I don't think it's quite true that I've been like, that I take Davidson's arguments very seriously. Like, I'm not super worried about them. I just think clearly there is an intuition that nothing is going wrong. The actor is not criticizable or something, which should be taken seriously. And either, you know, you can build a theory around that and go for the content view of mood, or you find some way of explaining that away. And like, maybe I'd like the content view of mood and taking Davidsonian intuitions more seriously if I saw like a good alternative way of explaining what the difference is between a sentence and a clause without resorting to force, but I don't. So that's why I like the force view of mood, yeah. And so like the Davidson argument, I mean, there is a point there. Like, you can't deny that there's a point there. Like, people, even if you give them these sorts of explanations that I give, they won't believe it, right? They'll like feel strongly for the other side. But like, from my point of view, you can say, well, yeah, but now, you know, all you're really having is this intuition that like we, you know, the actor's not criticizable. Like, we won't care, right? I mean, obviously, like, we won't care. But like, should that be explained by saying they're not making a linguistic mistake? Or should that be explained by saying we just don't care because we know they're acting? And I think, I mean, once you, and it's one of the cases I already reverted to too, but like, what are you gonna say about ouch if you don't think, like, no meaningful expression, you know, encodes like some sort of forcefulness, right? Like, what other view is there of ouch that like or what other natural view is there of ouch that, you know, you just, the use conditions are, you just have to be in pain. But then, of course, if the actor is saying ouch on stage and they're not in pain, they count as making a linguistic mistake. So the same problem arises all over, right? So I think if we sort of, Like the picture I think I have of like meaning and what the mood encodes is very simple and elegant. And of course it has these counterintuitive consequences, but like, you know, then things get messy and like I explain away some of those contrary intuitions. Whereas, you know, there's a different way of approaching this too.
Silver?
Yeah, thank you very much, Indrek. About this notion of the actor making a mistake but not being criticizable for it, I find this makes my mind... if he makes a mistake, there is something wrong about what he does. And if there is something wrong about what he does, we can call him up for what's wrong, you know? So it seems to me that to say he's making a mistake, but he's in no way criticizable for that. We are giving with one hand what you take away with the other, it seems to me. Yeah, I agree.
But I don't mean to deny that they're not like criticizable at all in this sense. What I meant was all we have intuitions about is whether like, you know, we would criticize them in general or whatever, like some sort of all things considered judgment. We're all these normative, you know, it's the same sort of relationship you can get in case of like, so suppose I invent a game which has like very immoral rules, right? To play by the rules of the game, you have to violate moral rules. Well, yeah, there's some sense in which, you know, this is what you should have done, you know, according to the rules of the game. And of course, all things considered, you shouldn't have done that. So you're like, all things considered, like you're doing something wrong. So I was intending this sort of a like non-criticizable. But like, of course they're making a linguistic mistake, they're criticizable in this sense. That's just a commitment that the view has. I have no like way of like backing away from that. Mm-hmm. All I'm saying is that our intuitions about these cases, and this is like a general point that I think is generally accepted, right? The same way in which, you know, we don't have like directly intuitions about semantic content, or you know, we have like some weird general intuitions that we then need to like somehow fit into our theory. Well, the same way I say, yeah, we have this intuition that, you know, the actor case is somehow different than the normal case. There's nothing going wrong in the actor case in some all things considered sense. That's what we need to make sense of. And I think we can make sense of this even if we insist that the actor Da is making a linguistic mistake if they're not in the use conditions. But then again, you know, if somebody gives a better explanation of the actor consistent with my theory, I'm like perfectly happy to jump there immediately. So
Mitchell?
Are we out of time?
We can take one more question.
Yeah, I'll reject.
Well, you can
just an expression of disbelief.
You can push me later. I mean, look, it's not as if I don't. Yeah, the first time I read the Dummett sort of response, I was also like, who's going to believe that? But, you know, you want to have an elegant, nice theory that has like some explanatory power, and then you're gonna always have these sorts of intuitions and. Or like, you know, as counterexamples, and you have to fit them in somehow, and like, I think you can fit them in somehow, but, you know, maybe like we can fit them in better if we understand the actor better, or like what it is to act or whatever. Maybe we just need to say more there, but I don't know. I mean, it's not like I don't feel the force of the intuitions or like, you know. So, yeah.
As long as you worry about it, that's good.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm worried enough.
Okay, so we should thank Indrek.
Thank you.